Welcome to the Sharp 600, brought to you by Carvers.com. I'm Rob Cressy, and I'm super excited to be jamming with you. And joining me to talk some MLB baseball post-trade deadline, as well as at the end, we have some NFL action preseason. We have our man, Josh Ingles, betting analyst for Covers.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Covers_Josh. Josh, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me again, Rob. Back, glad to be here. Quick little turnaround, a little pre-trade deadline, followed up with some post-trade deadline stuff. So also happy to be jamming, brother.
And one of the reasons why I wanted to do this back-to-back is because there is one thing that we said on the podcast that anybody listening, congratulations, and I know you took advantage of this. We sat there and we looked at the futures market from a who could win the World Series or even who could win the AL or the NL. And the one team that we identified was the San Diego Padres. At the time, this time last week, and we're recording this at 11:45 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday, and the Padres were sitting there, depending on the book, anywhere from 22-1 to 30-1 to win the World Series. And we said, you know what? This team is already all in on this year winning the World Series. They're already in the wild cards. They're a playoff contender. If you want to throw a few roulette chips out there for a team that could have a little bit more value if they make a splash, the Padres check all of the boxes. And guess what? The Padres made arguably the biggest move in MLB trade deadline history, acquiring 23-year-old star Juan Soto.
Yeah, a huge acquisition, but it was kind of rumored last week that they were in play, and we know that we saw with the Giants are the ones kind of trailing them in the division. The Giants kind of just gave up, it seems like, so... The Padres right now are up 3.5 games from the Giants in the wild card race. So they'll I'm pretty sure that they're to make playoffs is a market that you probably wouldn't be touching because of the juice on it now. But they'll be in the playoffs where they are. Now, the interesting thing this year is another angle that we should be looking at when you're looking at outrights is the playoff format, because it is different than years before, right? So that's why we're seeing the top two teams in each league. We see the Yankees, we see the Astros, we see the Dodgers, we see the Mets as such short favorites because they'll get a bye because of the expanded wild card. It's pretty cool that they'll be a best two of three now. So teams that are kind of like loaded on the front end, like San Diego is in the rotation with Musgrove and Darvish and Clevinger, they can get through that series pretty well. So we've saw them go from, we had them at what, plus 3,000, and now they're down to like 10-1. So some big moves there. Just the commitment itself, I mean, that's going to spark a locker room. They still got to go through the gauntlet, but I think they're more competitive versus teams versus the Mets, and if they can get all the way to a best of seven versus the Dodgers, then you're kind of rolling the dice there, and you're playing with house money, I think, at that point.
And speaking of the Mets, yesterday was a monumental day, the return of Jacob deGrom, arguably the best pitcher in all of baseball. So boom, everyone's excited. The Mets rolling in, minus 385 favorites, the second largest favorite this year to lose to the Nationals. Boom, goodbye Juan Soto. Boom, goodbye Josh Bell. Yeah. Here comes Jacob deGrom, and the Mets did what the Mets do. Anybody who follows Mets plus Jacob deGrom, deGrom gives us one run, three hits over five innings, and they lose. 94% of the bets on DraftKings were on the Mets. So, Josh, one of the things that I want to talk about is there has been this thing about fading minus 300 or greater teams on the season. MLB favorites of minus 300 or more are 20-10 on the season. So from a profitability standpoint, and I don't have the math in my head right there, but if you're winning once every three times on the underdog on these 3-1 and greater bets, doesn't that make it look like there is some attractiveness to that?
Is that a 33% return on investment at plus 300 if all of them are about plus 300? I would think somewhere in that. I don't know. It's fun. Like, But that's a really funny mentality that I think it takes mature bettors to do. I don't think recreational handicappers are going to be like, yeah, I'm just going to play the Nats just because of the number. Like on paper, obviously, all of that's priced in. They had no lineup. They're going against DeGrom. All of that's priced in. But it takes, I think, a savvy bettor to look at that and say, I'm going to put my money down on this against this minus 300 or this 3-1 underdog and kind of let it roll. Because on paper, it looks like a flaming pile of trash and there's not anything to like about it. And I'm sure every MLB preview for that game was, I bet you would probably only take 1 in 100. And one of the preview guys would say, I think this is an overreaction that most people aren't seeing to the market.
So, you know, my first thought actually was, which didn't necessarily factor in, but the end result ended up being differently. And there's a great book about this, and I've talked about it previously, called Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke, the former poker player. And it's all around creating your process and mindset, because sometimes you get pocket aces and you lose. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, all right, the Mets are monster favorites. Why would anybody ever want to be on the Nats? And I was like, well, this is DeGrom's first start. If nothing else, he's finally getting back into big league action. And we've seen, hey, sometimes it may take a start or two for anyone, elite caliber or not, to shake off some of the rust. So I could have bought into that narrative. Yes, it didn't end up going that way, but the Nats did end up winning. So for me, that was the more likely scenario is, hey, DeGrom might have slight rust going into this.
Absolutely. And I don't think he was... I don't think he was that sharp in his rehab start either, as I bring up the line. So it would have been perfect. If you were a smart bettor and you knew that this would be, everyone thinks it's an edge, but that edge was always, you're not ahead of the books in that edge that Washington just lost their entire, heart of their order. But we see Monday at 5:14 p.m., the Mets were minus 300. The overnight line took it to only minus 315, and then the trade jumped it up to minus 340, and then it just got bailed on, and it went to minus 370. So Washington closed at plus 290. So as a sharp bettor or a savvy bettor, and you wanted to get on that line, you would probably wait until game time because you knew the money was going to flood on the other side and then make your play then. So, yeah, you could plus 290. But there were angles. Like if I was writing the preview and I wanted to write against it, there were certain things that you could use, whether subjective or not, that you could make a case for Washington. And I think in the case of like, I see it in hockey a lot where teams just kind of get the hearts ripped out of them in that lineup. It kind of brings the rest of the locker room together. And like this mentality of no one wants us kind of puts things in perspective, and you see it. A team that has nothing to lose is a very dangerous team to play against.
Yeah, and I think that a great example of this, and don't quote me on who this was, but I believe it was Doc Rivers saying that when a team loses their star player, as we saw with the Clippers this year, all of a sudden they're wounded and they're actually a lot more dangerous because they're not resting on their proverbial laurels, the Paul George or the Kawhi Leonard. Now everybody gets the opportunity there. And we saw this year with the Clippers, they exceeded expectations. So it's always, this is something to put into our mindset hat. Just because a team loses a star player or they're going up against a star player does not automatically mean that things are going to go the way that they think. That being said, Josh, one of the things 1 week ago we talked about and you recommended strongly.
Let me just add one more thing to that, Rob. Sorry to cut you off on this.
Yes, go for it.
Your former Chicago guy, the Cubs was another perfect example of that. On the other side, the Cubs, they had Ian Happ and Wilson Contreras on the block all week. Everybody wanted them. Ian Happ was probably the best bat that was available after Soto, I think, pretty much. And then there was talk about them not being in the lineup, but they come out. They say they're not going to trade him. Ian Happ, Wilson Contreras stay in the lineup. And then they go, 7 hits, no runs last night versus Adam Wainwright and his 40-year-old arm. So it does go both ways. Even when you do get the stars in there, it doesn't necessarily just mean that it's going to happen and runs are going to happen. So you can look at it both ways. And if you're paying attention to it, there's certainly money to be made.
Right, because Juan Soto can still go 0-4 and win the MVP if he want. Like, welcome to baseball. Yeah, so
small sample size, exactly.
So one of the things that you were spot on for, we were looking at the AL MVP race, and 1 week ago we were sitting there, Aaron Judge was -110, Shohei Ohtani was +110. Fast forward 1 week later, Aaron Judge -420, Ohtani +390. It is over in the name of Vince Carter. That one is done. On the flip side, all of a sudden in the NL, there was some movement that we did not expect. Paul Goldschmidt was -155 a week ago. Today, he's -125 because Austin Riley, here he comes, goes from the third position. 1 week ago, he was 10-1. Today, he is 4-1. So he shot up a lot. Looking at the numbers, it's going to take an injury for Paul Goldschmidt to not win this because Riley still has a lot to go on the batting average and the RBIs. He's still behind on runs, but it is something of note. And why I want to bring this out is this is the advantage you get by having visibility into a market. So we had a snapshot. What I did is I screenshotted the odds for last week's podcast, and then I put them up against today's numbers. And you look at that and you're like, oh, you can get a better handle of the market. So if you're someone in any sport who wants to play the futures, start creating these benchmarks for yourself. Screenshot the numbers and you can start to see where there is movement and where there's opportunity.
I don't see the Riley business. I'm looking at FanGraphs right now. There's like a point.
So this point is on FanDuel.
Okay, so 0.5. WAR difference on FanGraphs here statistically, and there's guys. Dansby Swanson is higher in WAR than Austin Riley for Paul Goldschmidt. Goldschmidt's crushing him in average, beating him in slugging, crushing him in wins, runs created. Plus, there's really no statistic that I see that you would look at that and say no, Austin Riley is the better player. Austin Riley also, I think, has a better lineup ahead of him. And Goldschmidt, when you actually cut down to what the award is, I think that Paul Goldschmidt is probably the most valuable player to his team, considering the Cardinals lineup isn't as strong as you think it is.
Yeah, and what I would say is similar to what you said last week. I think this is Paul Goldschmidt's barring an injury. So I actually feel the same way you did last week about Aaron Judge. I feel that way about Paul Goldschmidt because I don't see him statistically being caught.
Yeah, I put them together on FanDuel. On FanDuel, you can parlay the NL and the AL MVPs together. So I did Judge and Goldschmidt together for like +225 when I believe Judge was like -160 or something. So I'm certainly watching that market and actually really surprised to see Goldschmidt get a little longer considering all the numbers say otherwise. Good metrics that actual people should be looking at are all in favor of Paul Goldschmidt. So pretty good price to get Goldschmidt, I would say.
Yeah, so the lesson for this, and I think it's actually contrarian to the way that we typically think. We love, especially in the futures market, to live in plus money. But over the last 2 weeks, what we've identified is two prohibitive favorites that when you looked at their body of work compared to who is at number two, it actually made sense for us to be laying the -110 or in this instance, the -125. It can oftentimes be seen as very square to be on the favorites, but if we're looking at the futures market, I think we've identified the process for how to break this down to say, wait a second, is this something that is advantageous for us? And I believe in both instances it is.
Yeah, and we just saw what Judge can do, and we saw the leap, the move from the market from week to week. I mean, out of the All-Star break, Judge was, like I said on the last pod, I think it was +160, and Shohei was actually the betting favorite. And then out of the gates, Judge just crushing the ball. New York is going to have another historic season, probably win the division by 14-plus games. There's no reason that he doesn't win it, and it just saw crazy movement. And now I think you're going to see it move like 100 points a week, basically going up there. So if you see that -300 next week, don't be surprised.
Josh, last baseball question before we get to NFL preseason. So with all these moves on the trade deadline for these teams, so the rich get richer.
The Minnesota Twins.
Right.
The Twins make great moves. Sorry, go ahead.
No, so the Twins, 1 week ago, sitting there at 50-1, and right now they're actually sitting at 60-1. So their odds actually got longer over the trade deadline.
And then they're leading the division. They got Tyler Mahle, they got Jorge Lopez, and they got a Fulmer. So they were a team that was actually a sneaky good offensive team, but just lacked front-end starters. Their front-end starters were like, what, Chris Archer, Sonny Gray. So there is some talent there. They just can't get deep. So they picked up some other arms, so they're deep. That division is a horse race right now with them, Chicago, and Cleveland. So I really think that I'm holding Cleveland to win the division at plus 400, but Minnesota made the better moves of the three teams, and at 60-1, they could finish as the number three seed because they're a division winner, face the number six seed in a best two of three, with home field advantage. So there's a lot to like for just winning the division. And at 60-1 for a team that you think can win the division and go on and just maybe make some noise, I mean, 60-1 is 60-1 for a team that has some pretty good odds to make the playoffs.
Do you need one round to be able to hedge in terms of, all right, you're sitting at a 60-1, they win their first round of the playoffs? Because a lot of times you look at this, and I call this the Denver Nuggets syndrome or the Utah Jazz syndrome. There's plenty of people who sit there. They're like, boom, I got the Nuggets 60-1. I'm sitting here gold. You're like, dude, that just throw that in the trash. It's a graveyard bet. That being said, at some point, as a team gets further on in the playoffs, you can start to hedge it to create a profitable ROI for you. So is it one win or one round in the playoffs? If you were to say, you know what, I like that they've moved up to 60-1. Can you turn that into a profitable bet?
There's so many moving pieces to it as to who the matchup comes down to, who's left, what the other noise is. You would have to basically see the matchup before, but like you said, there are opportunities that you can do that. In saying that, it's not like I mortgaged the house on something on these 60-1 futures, right? So the point of hedging is, was it a bet that you could live with just straight up losing? And at 60-1, at like a half a unit play, sure, you could hedge, but you're really cutting into your ROI when you're only investing half a unit to begin with. So these are just tickets that you kind of let ride. And maybe if you see something else down the road, if you see Minnesota down to the final four and you see maybe the long shot in the NL, maybe get a small piece of that for another half unit and then hope they meet up in the finals, something like that. But I wouldn't be going throwing another full unit down just to hedge to make like a 5% return on investment.
Yeah, and we previously had Zach Price on the podcast, who fancies himself as sort of like an investor when it comes to these things, because he flipped a Celtics at the midway point of the season ticket, and all of a sudden it became a lot more attractive as the Celtics got better in the second half. And actually, yeah. Josh, the thing that I want to ask you about is, for a team like the Padres or someone who makes moves, is that affecting how you cap on a day-by-day basis? We just talked about it. Juan Soto can go 0-for-4, but it's a lot more attractive for them on the long-term side of things. Is it really going to move the needle for us on the teams who are now even richer?
I think We're trying to get in at covers. We're trying to get into a preview aspect of writing as a handicapper as opposed to writing as just as a sports writer. And doing that, we're trying to – they keep Adam Chernoff and Brandon Bray are trying to talk us into finding angles in games that aren't covered in the price. So we saw that the Washington – their team was gutted. All of that was in the price, maybe too much in the price. So there are other angles that you look at just from a day-to-day perspective, and you kind of just you cut all the outside noise in, and then you just go through your handicapping process of what it is. You start off, you look at injuries. You don't have to – some splits are okay, but, like, really, does the head-to-head – is the head-to-head priced into every game? Is a team that's gone 10 of 12 versus one team? Is that a number that is really consistent when you're looking at pricing? So when San Diego gets everybody in the lineup and runs that Soto, Bell, Drury, and everybody else, they have Hader in that lineup, there might be an overreaction to how the books price those teams going forward. Because when you think that edge is so quickly and you think you know it, most of the time you're probably wrong, because 85, 90% of the public is probably already on that edge, and obviously not an edge at that point. So there are just other things to dig into. I'm sure they'll be a very good team to fade if there's certain points to look at. We'll see how Hader does as a closing and relief pitcher in there, because he had some issues in Milwaukee. So there's certainly points that we can look at. But in the handicapping process, look at the price, see what's priced in, try to find things that aren't priced in, try to find expected metrics that there should be regressions for some players who are hitting too well, pitchers who are pitching poorly, but ERA and other things are indicating better. And those are kind of the smaller edges I think you can have. Another great edge, following relief pitchers, seeing how teams use bullpens and seeing what arms are available in day-to-day, because those are also things that aren't priced into. And obviously, I think when I'm doing my handicapping, the first thing I'm going to is weather, because I think that's one of the last things that public bets on that books adjust to during the day, that you kind of see those lines move and totals move based on weather. So those are kind of the things you look at macro-wise, and just kind of cut out the noise of this is game 2 of 3 in the series. This is a getaway game. The over 7-2 in the last 9 meetings and stuff like that. When you kind of simplify things and just try to work on one edge, I think it's better than and trying to write and preview a game as a sports writer, like from MLB.com, as opposed to a handicapper.
Yeah, and remember, there is a new team, new scenario struggle, a.k.a. what we saw with Francisco Lindor starting the year, gets brand new contract, goes to the Mets. How is that possible? Well, this is more of a pricing thing. So when we saw the line go from minus 300 to minus 310 to minus 385, that's all this movement. So maybe here we're looking for these little inches that say, all right, I'm aware that pricing could be slightly off. We're looking for the percentage points, because if we're looking to hit 53%, all right, this is a long-term mindset. So in terms of process, Josh, this is actually our segue to the NFL is back. And the NFL gifted us a gem in the Hall of Fame game. We've got the Raiders taking on the Jaguars. Game is going down on Thursday. Line opened up, Jags favored by 1.5, total 33.5. As we sit here on Wednesday, Raiders now favorite 2.5, over under, it's going down, it's at 30.5. Not likely to have starters, no Trevor Lawrence, no Travis Etienne, likely no Derek Carr, so we're going to have a lot of middling players. On covers, you wrote the preview for this. What a gift for yourself. Drop some knowledge for us. God.
Oh yeah, that was basically when you're doing these NFL preseason and doing the first one's so difficult, because I mean they just put pads on last Wednesday, so basically all you're doing from a handicap point of view is just scouring both beat writers and just trying to find small nuggets of information that, as we go back to what we were saying before, might not be baked into these lines that. Every time I'm talking about this, as bettors, the books don't have an advantage over us over the gift of information that's out there. You can dig in and find stuff. And I don't think there's a market that's more beatable to get information than NFL preseason. Now, it's tough to correlate that information over the course of a full NFL game in the preseason, because there's so many changing pieces and so many quarterbacks coming in. But if you have a good mind about how you can use that information and put it towards the certain NFL markets, and I think there are edges to be had. And we saw crazy movement already in the total, going from like 33.5 to 32.5 and now to 30.5, and then which was basically a pick 'em, and now moved as high as -3 for the Raiders, and now sits at -2.5. And we have covers his own Raz Right Angle Sports release show to thank for that, because they released the Raiders last night and immediately moved the entire market. Absolutely insane. Watching the odds boards just go up, the influence that they have. So I'm sitting here as a guy who did his darndest handicapping, dug into everything, found some angles I like. I settled on the Jaguars at plus 100 on the money line. And then the Raz release show goes the other way. So I kind of feel stupid. But in saying that, it is a spread of 2.5 with a total of just 30.5. So these individual points on the side, on the spreads, are massive when we're considering a game that has a total of 30.5. So 30.5 is a number probably won't move. We're expecting some rain, kind of 9-mile-an-hour winds, humidity's high, temperatures like kind of in the high 80s, which is a little hot for this time of the year for guys to be slugging away. So we could see some sloppy conditions. So I probably wouldn't be torching the over 30.5. But what we do know is Jacksonville will be going with Jake Glutton and Kyle Sloter. So Sloter is a guy who will probably get to play the third and fourth quarters. He's got like a season. He hasn't played an NFL snap in the regular season, but he's played like 11 games in the preseason. He just finished his USFL stint with the New Orleans Breakers. So he's like in mid-season form. And so he's trying to crack the number three spot. So I think he'll be balling. He has a 75% completion rating over his 11 games in the NFL preseason. So he's kind of balling in the preseason. So I know Adam Chernoff's really high on him. I'm high on him. And in these NFL preseason games, quarterback play is so important. So I kind of like him kind of to draw. And we don't have these markets. So I would like it maybe a second half Jacksonville money line, but that doesn't exist right now. So I might have to wait for that betting angle that I like Sloter to be the better player later in games. And he'll get to face, obviously, what, threes and fours from the Raiders. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, McDaniels hasn't been thrilled with the way his team's played so far. He's kind of come out and talked some smack about his O-line. And they left their training camp early to go to Canton to go do their little tour of the Hall of Fame. Well, Jacksonville stayed and got another day of practice. So an extra day of practice with pads when you've only done them for like 7 days is kind of an angle. So it is the first game. Don't expect too much. I think the average total closing for these games is like 29.3 over the last 15 games. So when we're handicapping these such low total games, I think it's so funny as a bettor, you're watching there, you're like, awful offenses, just garbage. But then you get the ball on your own 15, go 3 and out, and then you give the ball to the other team at the 45, their own 45. It can, poor offenses can create short fields for other poor offenses. So it can kind of go the other way sometimes when you're handicapping these low total games.
Also of note, the under has hit in 9 of the last 16 Hall of Fame games. And Josh, when you're like 75% completion percentage, I'm like, wow, the Jags are starting Chad Pennington. This is starting to sound a lot more attractive to me.
No, I know. He's a former wide receiver in college. He's an athletic guy. His tape's really good. He looked great in Minnesota. He's been up and down. He just hasn't really got that crack. And I think the advantage of him playing in the USFL, what, 8 games plus playoffs, I mean, that's a huge amount of football that this guy's been playing compared to maybe, the threes, the fours. I'm trying to figure out. So Derek Carr probably won't play. Mullins will play. Jared Stidham, who was also a Josh McDaniels guy in New England, he didn't play at all last year due to a back injury, so he'll be seeing his first live reps. And then their number four is undrafted rookie quarterback Garber. So there's not a lot to like, but obviously Right Angle Sports does like it. And, I mean, they're one of the most influential betting syndicates in all of football. So there's a reason they like them. But on the same sense, I do like Jacksonville later in the third and fourth quarters because of Sloter.
Josh, there is so much to like because football is back. Baseball is getting into where things actually matter now. Really enjoy jamming with you. Where can everybody connect?
Come find me on Twitter. I'll be sweating. What am I sweating today? What is it? I don't even know. The Champions League qualification soccer bets during the afternoon to get some action. So I'll be sweating those. Sweating baseball. We got afternoon baseball. I mean, it is the home stretch there. And now And now with football, now we need to be paying attention to like every beat writer just to find information to beat these player prop markets that are getting crazy efficient now. So really looking forward to the transition right now from a handicapping process to dig all into the NFL. So find me on Twitter, call me a donkey, debate, I don't care. That's where I'll be. Engagement's engagement, right, Cressy?
Of course. And I want to hear from you. Number one, did you get in on any futures action in MLB before the trade deadline? And number two, are you going to roll in and bet anything in the Hall of Fame game? You can hit me up on Instagram or Twitter at Rob Cressy. Also, make sure to tag at Covers. And remember, if you want to be a sharp, don't be a square with your bankroll. Be disciplined with your money.